The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's a pleasure to be here this morning. For some silly reason, I kind of feel happy to be sitting up on this platform so I can see all you out there. I'm not so tall, so I get to be a little bit taller. So today I'd like to talk a little bit about storytelling. And not in the usual way often that we talk about storytelling in the Buddhist circles. Often, I know I've done this, I've kind of said, oh, that's just a story I'm telling myself. Or, oh, that's just a story that somebody is believing. But in fact, stories can be really helpful. They can be supportive. And Joseph Campbell, who some of you may know, is a scholar of like mythology and teaches about it. He said that stories and myths were metaphors that help guide and comfort people. So we can kind of explore how stories can guide and comfort ourselves and those around us. And I'm also like a big fan of the lists in Buddhism, but it's not always appropriate to be thinking about a list or to go into the list. Four Noble Truths, Five Faculties, Seven Factors of Awakening, Eightfold Path, right? There's lots of these lists. So they go together, in my view. Sometimes the lists are more appropriate and sometimes the stories. So I'd like to tell you a story that is captured in the earliest discourses of the Buddha. And this is a story within a story. And that will become clear as I go along. But it begins with the Buddha talking right before he dies. So right before his death, maybe even hours before he dies. And he's not feeling well, the Buddha, and he goes to bathe. And then when he comes out of the river, he puts on some new robes. And Ananda, his attendant, who has been, you know, his companion in helping take care of the Buddha and take care of all the kind of administrative stuff of the Buddha for decades beforehand, and I was very close to the Buddha. Ananda says, comments that the Buddha's skin is especially clear and bright. So he's noticing that the Buddha looks different. And then the Buddha responds, Ananda, there are two occasions that a Buddha's skin is especially clear and bright. The first occasion is when a Buddha attains enlightenment. So that is when the person becomes a Buddha. Their skin becomes particularly clear and bright. We know this has already happened because he's the Buddha. The second occasion when a Buddha's skin is particularly clear and bright is right before he dies. And I'm imagining Ananda goes, like, what? And the Buddha declares that he's going to die that evening. And he asks Ananda to prepare a bed for him in a particular place underneath these particular trees in the distance. So Ananda does this, and the Buddha goes and he lies down in the place that Ananda had prepared for him. And he adopts the lion posture, laying on his right side with one foot on the other, mindful and clearly aware. So he adopts this particular posture. Ananda leaves, and he returns to where he was staying, and he stood crying. And he's leaning on the doorpost, on the like the door frame of the place where he was staying. He's weeping and wailing. Later, the Buddha asks, well, what happened to Ananda? And the monks say, well, he went back to his lodging and he's crying. And the Buddha says, well, go tell him to come speak to me. So Ananda returns. And the Buddha says to him, Ananda, do not weep and wail. Have I not already told you that all things that are pleasant and delightful are changeable, subject to separation and becoming otherwise? So how could it be, Ananda, that since whatever is born must pass away, how could it be that I should not die at some time? Ananda says, okay, this is my interpretation, but please don't die here, in this place, in this town of Kusinara. And this is how the translator of this particular discourse describes it. May the Blessed One not die in this miserable little town of Wattle and Daub, right in the jungle of the back of beyond. I love these expressions, right? So I'll unpack this a little bit. Wattle and Daub. It sounds kind of funny and playful, but when I looked it up, it's actually an ancient architectural style, where we can think of wattle as kind of like a wood planks, and daub is like clay that goes in between them. So he's describing that this town is made in this way. In the jungle, as we know this, and in the back of beyond, our translator here is a Brit, and this is a British expression that means, you know, way out in the middle of nowhere. And I think parts of Australia actually have this nickname of the back of beyond. So Ananda says, please don't die here in this miserable little town. And he says, Ananda gives a list of other cities that would be more appropriate for which the Buddha to die. And then the Buddha says, no, I'm going to die here because this location used to be the capital city of Kusavati, which was ruled by a rightful and righteous king. And Kusavati was a rich, prosperous, well-populated city that was crowded with people and well-stocked with food. The city was filled with sounds of elephants and horses, carriages, music, singing, and cries of eat, drink. So now starts the beginning of a story that the Buddha is going to tell Ananda to kind of help soothe Ananda, who is upset that the Buddha is about to die. And of course, right, the Buddha is teaching and taking care of his followers, you know, even until his dying moments. So one way he does is to tell a story. So now here's this story of what happened in this city that right now seems like just a miserable little town in the middle of the jungle, but many, 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 many years before was a magnificent city, Kusavati. And the king of the region of that area was called Mahasudasana. And then the Buddha tells this story. So a long, long time ago, so our translator here, he does say, once upon a time, we could also translate that as like formerly, just this recognition that it happened a long time ago. Once upon a time, there was a king who saw up in the sky a wheel. We could understand that, I don't know, an orb, something roundish in the sky. And the king has this feeling that he should follow this orb, this wheel, that it's somehow important and could lead him to something important. So the wheel heads east, and the king takes his, with his elephants and his horses and his ministers, a whole big group heads east. And then where the wheel stopped in the sky, the king and this big giant retinue stops. And then the kings of those regions in the east come to King Mahasudasana and say, Come, Your Majesty, you're welcome. We are yours to rule. Please rule us. So they just subjugate themselves to him. And the king responds to this by saying, please do not take life. Do not take what is not freely given. Do not commit sexual misconduct. Do not tell lies. Do not take intoxicants. And please be moderate in eating. So for those of you who've been in the Buddhist scene, recognize that these are for the first five precepts, right? A way to kind of an ethical behavior. So this king, when he comes to this new land, his teaching is to please behave ethically. And then they put in moderate in eating. At this time, at the time of the Buddha in ancient India, moderate in eating means both don't eat too much and don't eat too little, because that was part of some of the spiritual practice of some of the competing religious ideas of the time. So then the wheel goes to the south, and the king goes to the south, same thing happens. And then he goes to the west, same thing happens. And he goes back to the north, same thing happens. Right. So all the lands all around are now under this king, and they're all behaving ethically. So the king returns to the capital, and it's described as this beautiful, splendid place. And the king says, suppose I were to construct lotus ponds for the people. And he did so. And these lotus ponds were beautiful. They had four colored tiles, colors of gold, silver, beryl, which is like an emerald, but aquamarine color, and crystal. And then the lotus ponds had staircases, and these were gold, silver, beryl, and crystal. And then the king thought, suppose I were to put flowers in the ponds so that anybody who wished could come and collect flowers and make garlands. And he does so, with blue, yellow, red, and white flowers. You get the sense here, right, that this story is very kind of elaborate and colorful. And then the king says, suppose I were to place attendants on the banks of these ponds to help all who come there. And with the attendants, I'll put charitable posts so that those who have need of food, drink, clothing, transport, a sleeping place, or money, they could just come to the banks of these lotus ponds and take what is needed. The town is very happy. And then some of his wealthy subjects, they feel so happy, they want to offer him a great donation, a giant donation, as a sign of their appreciation. But the king rejects it and says, I already have enough wealth. I don't need any more wealth. But the wealthy subjects, they don't want to take the money back, so they say, well, we'll build a palace. We'll build a new palace for the king. The gods hear this and they get such a great idea. They agree to help. So this palace gets built that was three times a person's height with tiles of four colors. You guessed it, gold, silver, beryl, and crystal. And then the description of this describes the columns, the staircases, the rooms, the chairs, and the doors. This long, lengthy description of how that is just dazzling, right? It's beautiful. And surrounding the palace was a net of tinkling bells. And when these bells were stirred by the wind, their sound was lovely, delightful, sweet, and intoxicating. So you can tell why this is a story, right? Everything's a little bit over the top. So then he says, well, I have this fantastic palace. Maybe I'll make another lotus lake in front. And he proceeds to do that. That's like the lotus ponds elsewhere in the city. And then he thinks about all the spiritual practitioners, the mendicants in the area, and he takes care of them, giving them alms and robes. So the townspeople, as well as the people maybe who aren't townspeople as much as kind of the mendicants, the recluses. Then he decides to go into the palace and to go into retreat. So even though everything is so wonderful, so beautiful, over the top, he doesn't stay there and just, indulge in all this beauty. He wants to pursue his spiritual life, so he goes into the palace. And before he sits down, he asks, why, or of what action is it the fruit? Of what action is it the result that I am now so mighty and so powerful? How did I get here, is what he's reflecting. For me, I think this is very powerful because so often in the Buddha studies or stories is, or even the teachings, is this idea of when we find ourselves suffering to ask ourselves, how did I get here? And of course, the Buddhist teachings tell us about, you know, what are all the different forms of suffering and what are the different causes of suffering. But here's a king who has, you know, over the top, everything's fantastic, right? And to be the king in a lay person's terms is also kind of like the symbol of the highest status, the highest pinnacle of what one can be, and to have everything that you need, and people respect you and want to give you gifts. So he's not tyrannical, people are behaving themselves. How did I get here? I should also say, when he says, how did I get so mighty and powerful, that this expression, mighty and powerful, elsewhere in the discourses is used only to describe the Buddha or the Buddha's most senior disciples. So he's describing himself using language that the Buddha also describes himself in some places. And then the king considers, how did I get here? And then what arises in his mind, it is there were three actions that I did that made me so mighty and so powerful. These three actions were generosity, inner taming, and self-mastery. So I'm going to talk about these three here for a little bit. Generosity, giving. We saw that the king did this, right, with giving the lotus ponds, with then the food and the clothing. So we can see how his he took care of the people who were his responsibility under his leadership. And he also gave them practical things that were of benefit to them here and now. But we don't always, generosity isn't dependent on what we give necessarily. It's also that we are giving, it's the activity of giving. Often we feel good when we give to others, when we support others. There can be an opening, a softness of our hearts when we're generous. It helps us feel also like we have enough. It counteracts that sense of this feeling of lack if we're able to give or be generous. Also, when we're generous, we're taking other people's welfare into our awareness. It's not just about me, 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 or what do I need or what I can do. Often when we're giving to others, it's a way to connect with others. It can be a way to have some, like a benevolent action, or even to acknowledge that there are others. Sometimes, right, it's very easy to do this, to be just concerned and consumed, not because we're bad people, just because it's easy to do, to be consumed when we're in pain, when we have suffering, when we have difficulty. So this practice of generosity is to remind us that actually we are in community, all of us, in some way or another, with others. And also in this way, generosity helps nurture our relationships. Whether it's our close, intimate friends and partners that we are generous with, or if it's just a sense of generosity in terms of acknowledging somebody, smiling, saying hello, lending a helping hand, these types of things, right? They help support our relationships that may sometimes, especially in our close relationships, may get dull or heavy. Generosity is an uplifting activity. So the king reflects that part of the reason how he became so mighty and powerful was that he was generous. And then the second is that this inner taming. So the Pali word that's being translated as taming here is related to the word for home. So like to come home, like to domesticate, right? Just to kind of like to tame. So in this way, to be with ourselves here and now in such a way, not that we're self-obsessed, but in such a way that we don't abandon ourselves. That we don't just, when we discover that we've made a mistake or we discover that something isn't going well, that we don't just throw up our hands and say, well, I give up. When you discover that you've eaten 3 brownies, instead of saying, well, hell, I may as well just eat the whole box or whatever it is, right? Or a friend explained it to me in a way that really was helpful for me to think about this. She gave the analogy that when you discover that you're driving and you have a flat tire and you pull over to take care of the flat tire, you don't get out and then stab the other 3 tires. Right? It just, okay, if I'm going to have a flat tire and stuck here on the road, I may as well do this. No, it's just 1 tire. You fix that. You take care of that. So this idea of inner taming is to kind of not abandon ourselves, to stay with ourselves. It also, inner taming has this sense of we don't have to be someone or something we're not. Right? Inner taming is not saying, please transform yourself into something completely different. It's just saying, stay here with who you are, with how things are. And maybe let's tame the wild parts in a right way, right? With wisdom. We're not saying there can't be some freedom and spontaneity and ease and all that. Of course, that's not what we're saying. But just like if a lion gets tamed, we're not trying to teach the lion to act like an elephant or a dolphin. We're just trying to have the lion not eat the lion tamer, right? So in the same way, kind of with inner taming. And also inner taming can refer to, we can tame our tendencies to be harsh with ourselves, to be harsh with others, to be disappointed in ourselves, to be disappointed in others. Or tame ourselves perhaps with the tendency to want to distract ourselves and not really be present for our lives and what's happening. But instead to just be here now with who we are and to tame, what are some other words? I don't have any right now that come to mind, but I think this idea of just not letting being the best version of ourselves, letting the wisdom that we have kind of shine through. So the king reflects that how he became so mighty and powerful is that, one, he had generosity. 2, we had this inner taming. And 3 is self-mastery. Right, so mastery implies that, you know, particularly proficient or skillful. And of course, when we think of masters of anything, any skill, I think all of us just assume that this person has practiced a whole lot, right, in order to become a master in their field. So in the same way, is this pointing towards self-mastery is to practice consistently. And this requires awareness, diligence, and patience. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Buddhist practice, meditation practice, or playing tennis, right? It's all the same awareness to notice what's happening. If you're playing tennis, to notice how you're holding the racket or hitting the ball or how your feet are or whatever it might be. But with the Buddhist spiritual practice or even just a meditation mindfulness practice, mastery is to notice, not only what's happening, I'm lost the breath, I'm now lost in thought, but also to notice what are some of our underlying beliefs, what are some of our expectations we may have. And that relates to the inner taming I talked about earlier. Like, it's not only seeing what's on the surface, but to see what's underneath, what's fueling our restlessness, perhaps, or what's fueling our wish to meditate, to tap into the kind of more, the deeper sense of what's going on, in addition to the obvious things that are going on the surface. So part of self-mastery requires awareness. Also requires diligence, right? Persistence, assiduousness, care, effort. This isn't a surprise to anybody. We all know this. I think part of the secret here is to know how much effort, how to do it with care, without striving and straining and applying ourselves in a way that isn't sustainable and then collapsing. So part of the inner taming is to also to notice that those times when we are getting a little bit out of balance and are striving too much, and then we end up abandoning ourselves because we're just exhausted. So part of self-mastery is not only to have diligence and persistence, but to do it in a way that is sustainable and is consistent as best we can. Right? This is definitely a practice. And I know for myself, I often don't know when I'm striving too hard until I notice how exhausted I am. Like, oh, right. It's like such a lifelong habit to want to do more and more and more. I got to get more, do more, be more, say more. Oh, you know, all these things, right? It's so easy to fall into that. So it's often when I've gone over one side, then I'm like, oh, okay, come back to the center. And then I often sometimes don't know that when I'm not applying enough effort, when I've kind of find myself just drifting off in complacency, and then I'm doing things that really don't matter, or I find myself completely disconnected from everything that's going around me and lost in doing silly things that really I don't want to spend my time and energy doing. So it definitely is a practice. And then patience, right? This self-mastery doesn't happen overnight. We all know this. We would all be perfect already if it did. So just to be patient and to notice that it is a process, it is a practice, and to notice when we're feeling impatient, or to notice when we are having expectations that aren't getting met. Most likely our expectations are not getting met. And then just to notice that. It's like, oh, can I soften that? Can I soften that I'm going to meet my aspirations, these ideas of how I would like to be right now? I want to head in that direction, but I don't have to achieve them at this moment. This idea of self-mastery also builds on the idea of to cultivate the gifts and talents we have. Right, all of us have gifts and talents, and to cultivate them and nurture them and support them and not think that they should be otherwise. Of course, right, you know, when we think of Beethoven, he was somebody who had gifts in a particular area. Doesn't mean that he had gifts in all other areas and we don't chastise him for not being a great mathematician or something. This was his contribution. Maybe it's not clear to us what our great contribution is going to be, and maybe there isn't a great contribution. But to work with our strengths, to work with our talents, in a way that we can develop some skillfulness and some mastery, in a way that makes sense for us. So the king asks, getting back to the story, how did I get here? Comes to his mind that there were three things that he had done: generosity, inner taming, and self-mastery. So then he goes into an inner room in the palace and he thinks, may thoughts of greed cease. May thoughts of ill will cease. May thoughts of harming cease. And then he sits down to meditate on this couch that is gold with silver and right, all this kind of a beautiful embellishment. So for me, I think it's kind of remarkable that he just thinks to himself, may these thoughts cease. The story doesn't say, like, if that happened right away, kind of implies it. But maybe he has some certain amount of self-mastery and can incline his mind in a particular way. I don't know. But he does set the intention that this is the direction he's going to go. He's going to clear his mind of things that get in the way of settledness or things that get in the way of openness, softness, of greed, ill will, and harming. Some of you that are familiar with the hindrances will notice that these are some of the classic qualities of the mind that get in the way or hinder, quote unquote, are getting settled. So he sits down to meditate and he becomes very concentrated. And then after becoming concentrated, he gets up and goes to yet another room. And one of these other rooms, he practices loving kindness, kind of pervading all directions with loving kindness. Having done that for a while, he then pervades all directions with compassion. And then sympathetic joy, and then equanimity. Some of you may recognize this as the four Brahma-Viharas practices. So after a while, his wife, the queen, notices that the king has been gone for quite a while. And in this story, it says that he's been gone for 100,000 years. I think to kind of highlight, right, the grandiosity and the hyperbole here or something like this. It is a long time since I saw King Mahasudasana. Suppose I were to go see him. So she goes to the chamber where the king is and stood leaning against the doorpost. And she sees that the king has adopted the lion's posture. He is lying on his right side with one foot on the other, mindful and clearly aware. She sees that the king, his complexion is very clear and bright. Right? Read this kind of like a... She thinks, wow, King Mahasudasana's faculties are purified. His complexion is clear and bright. I hope he's not dead. And in an effort to rouse him, she starts to tell him about all his great possessions. Just think, you're the ruler of this giant land that has all these cities that are so beautiful, and all these lotus ponds that are taking care of the people, and there's all these palaces, and all, she goes through all the list, right, with the gold and the silver and the beryl and the crystal. And the king gets roused and says to her, for a long time, queen, you spoke pleasing, delightful, attractive words to me. But now, at this time, your words are unpleasing, undelightful, and unattractive. Well, sire, then how am I to speak to you? You should tell me this. All things that are pleasant and delightful are changeable, subject to separation and becoming otherwise. Do not die filled with longing. To die filled with longing is painful. The queen starts crying. And she says what the king asked her to say. Dear sire, all things that are pleasant and delightful are changeable, subject to separation and becoming otherwise. Do not die filled with longing. To die with longing is painful. And then soon after, the king died. And just as a person might feel drowsy after a good meal, so the king felt the sensation of very gently passing away. And then he is reborn in the heavenly realm. Right? This is a story of like what happened way before. So now we come back to the other story, where the Buddha just finished telling this story about King Mahasudasana to Ananda. You'll have recognized many of the parallels, right? And the Buddha says to Ananda, Ananda, I was King Mahasudasana. Right, so he's referring to that he had former lives. This is kind of in the Buddhist teachings. I don't think it's important whether we believe this or not, but it's part of how this whole storytelling takes place. As a little aside, I will say that the stories of the Buddha's past lives, there's hundreds and hundreds of them, called Jataka tales. They are filled with tales of how to behave, of kind of like morality tales, maybe like Grimm's fairy tales we would think of today. So in this story, the Buddha is about to die, and he tells Ananda, look, I've been here before. And the person who, when I was a king, I was like when I was a lay person, not a spiritual person, I was the most senior one possible. I did all these wonderful things, and I died a very peaceful death. I just kind of letting Ananda know and how I'm interpreting this, it's going to be okay. And then the Buddha says to Ananda, see how all of those conditioned states were impermanent? Like, you know, what I just told you was long ago. It passed away. All conditioned things are unstable and can bring us no lasting comfort. So Ananda, all conditioned things are impermanent, arising and passing away. Having been born, they must all cease. And then the Buddha died. I should say, they do describe his meditation practice before he died, but those were his last words. I feel myself very touched by this, how he's taking care of Ananda, who had taken care of the Buddha in such a way by telling this story. And also I think it's a beautiful way to kind of teach this truth of impermanence, just like this story supposedly took place in the past. The Buddha is saying, you know, what happened in the past, look, reflect on that. That's not here and now. What's here and now is not a source of lasting comfort. And we, elsewhere in the discourses, we see where the Buddha himself is asking himself, how do things arise? What are the conditions for things? Just like the king asked, how did I become so mighty and powerful? The Buddha had asked, what is the cause of suffering? So we can ask ourselves, like, how did I get here? How are things connected? What am I creating the conditions for? And we might remember about generosity, inner taming, and self-mastery. And to practice these in an open-handed way, because all conditioned things are impermanent. Thank you. I'll stay up here.